over the air. John, we broke off talking about the question of whether sanctions hurt or help the Russian economy. I think about China, and China is the quiet partner in all of this so far. Everybody, the rumored next target or current target, depending on how you how the metrics are understood. But China, in getting isolated by the Americans with tariffs and sanctions and other underhanded methods, joined by Canada notably and some of its other allies, has managed to grow stronger and stronger and has managed to replace the technologies the Americans have thrown blocks between them and those technologies on their own. I think that it's pretty obvious that that has been a massive own goal by the Americans, and they've enabled China in ways. There's a reason that the Chinese call Trump the builder of China, and his predecessor too. They have profited by America's actions. I wonder that Russia is not in the same boat, if to a lesser degree.
Yes, Russia is in the same boat, but it's not appreciated in the same degree. That's because President Putin is much more beholden to the Russian oligarchs, first created in the Yeltsin period in 1996. He's much more beholden and controls them less than President Xi controls the Chinese oligarchs in China. And I have to defer to a much wiser and better informed experts on China in the United States and in China itself to explain the Chinese politics or their political economy of mixed state and private enterprise control in China. I can't do it. I can revert to doing what I do, which is to focus on the way the Russian economy works. And the Russian economy doesn't work as a state-controlled, first primarily state-controlled, Putin-controlled economy until the war came. War mobilization requirements increase the degree to which state control returns, but it doesn't approach the level of Chinese state control in the Chinese economy. In this situation, China is much more adaptable to these pressures than Russia has been, and that's why Russia was very, very slow between 2014 and 2022 to react to the growing security threat, which the military intelligence understood perfectly well, was the fortification of a battlefield aimed ultimately on the Ukrainian side in retaking the Crimea, retaking the Donbas, and threatening once again the Russian hinterland and creating the precedent for increased NATO creep and pressure from Finland in the north, from the Arctic and Greenland in the far north, and in the south, the pressure on Iran as the soft underbelly of Russia, which it's always been. So Russia has not got the level of state control of the economy that China has had. Russia gave it up to the Americans under Yeltsin from 1991 on, and Putin has not had the political strength or the ideological conviction to interfere with and recover and reclaim that power. That has always struck him as Putin personally as too similar to the communist system. That's not a deterrent for President Xi. And his power personally, his predilections personally, have been with a subgroup of oligarchs, and he's been reluctant over a long period of time to counter their interests. And to illustrate how that works, I've written The Dances with Bears for many years now, and that specializes in case studies, oligarch by oligarch, economic case, business case by business case. And the book, The Sovcom Plot, is a story of how Putin changed his mind in the favor of the Russian oligarchs who wanted to take over the Russian shipping company, Sovcomflot, and all of the truth of what happened spilled out in a 15-year court record in the High Court, the Court of Appeal, and even the Supreme Court in the UK. Because those records were available, because I was involved in shipping reporting at the time, because I was able to talk with everybody on all sides in that case, I was able to tell the story of an attempt to privatize the dominant Russian shipping company in Russia, the dominant oil and gas shipping company in the world, and how it ended. And you can see a story of Putin's change of mind, his vacillation, his indecisiveness in that case. Now, it doesn't stretch the imagination too far to understand that that's also what's happened on the military front and on the military industrial front. And it's been a severe, sorry, painful, expensive lesson for us all in Russia, not least of all the inhabitants of the Kremlin, to understand that war making doesn't tolerate vacillation. Vacillation costs lives. Delay costs lives. And this has been a lesson that the general staff has been learning and has been learning from and applying to reverse what was lost between 2014 with the putsch in Kiev and now.
Paul Craig Roberts would say it was being overkind. The American writer and Politico says that he just simply says Putin, well, not only, but he says Putin is a sellout. And that's he's not vacillating. He's playing deals to enrich his friends and presumably himself. And that's what's causing this greater loss of life. His delays and vacillation of policy is because they're using that to enrich themselves.
Well, I can say two things. First of all, the famous expression from the wonderful House of Cards series, that's your comment. Oh, that's Paul Craig Roberts's comment. I can't possibly, that's your view. I can't possibly comment. We could say it that way. Or because Craig and I interact privately by email and on the telephone, I've attempted to say going so far as he sometimes does is to go too far. And it's to misunderstand that Russian presidential politics is factional politics of the very familiar kind, in which class interests, business interests, individual interests contest for presidential decision and government consensus. And Putin therefore has to, he, Putin believes, the system agrees, has to compromise on all sorts of decisions, whether it's the level of pollution that has poisoned the climate in Chelyabinsk for many years, because Putin will not deal with and remove the oligarch responsible for pollution in Chelyabinsk, Igor Zyuzin. That's one part. The other part is the delay that's involved in making decisions, changing decisions, making up minds, changing minds, applying force, putting limits on force, and so on. All of these things are the result of a much more complicated political system than Craig has suggested to exist. So all I can say is that Craig and I, Paul Craig Roberts and I, differ on the conclusion. We agree on the method. And in the last couple of days or the last week, it seems to me he has been writing an account of how the Washington decision-making puts Russia and Putin in a position where it can do, as I've called it, a bad deal for good Russian reasons. And calling the president of Russia names doesn't help change the good Russian reasons behind this.
Well, in your article, and again, Russia is ready for a bad deal with Trump for good Russian reasons, you quote a source saying that, we talked about this off air too, but loosely quoted here, come 2028, if Trump loses, This is in regards to the 30-day truce, or true, actually, sorry, the 3-year truce that is being kicked around behind the scenes. Come 2028, if Trump loses, the war will start all over again, but the Russians will get it right, presumably the next time. This come 2028, if Trump loses, seems to suggest that Trump will be running for president in 2028, something that the Constitution, as it stands right now, doesn't allow a third presidential term. Is this what your Russian writer is alluding to? And is this what is, how common, if so, is this belief in Russia that there's, Trump's got another term in him yet?
Well, I think that Russian intelligence agencies wouldn't be doing their job if they weren't very well aware that this is being actively debated in the United States. What constitutional manipulations might allow Trump to run for the third term, which is banned by the U.S. Constitution. And to that end, you've seen the reports that the Trump campaign is now already issuing Trump for 2028 hats. The Atlantic interviews, both the telephone one and the Oval Office one, which followed, and the article which has followed, that the Atlantic wants to make you sell to buy for their profit. Don't do that. It's indicated that Trump says he won't run, but that's normal for a president at this stage to say. The evidence is that he will find the legal reasons to run again or to exercise power in a combination rather like Putin and Medvedev used to evade the constitutional limitation on Putin's term limits when Dmitry Medvedev moved from the prime ministry to the presidency. Putin moved to the prime ministry, and they then changed seats again. There are a variety of ways, I won't get into them now, which Trump could use to evade the constitutional third term limit. So Russians are very well aware of this, and they have to say, and it's the argument of that source, but also of the factions around, the business factions, as well as some of the foreign policy advisors around Putin. What they're saying is, look, we've got an opportunity here that didn't exist so long as Biden and Obama were in power. And that was a president who's willing to talk to us to reduce tension between the United States and Russia, to reduce the cost of war making for us, and to increase the business opportunities that would arise if we get our central bank reserves back and so forth. So let's take the opportunity now before he loses the capacity as president to keep that opportunity or that door or window open. That's the argument. The contrary argument is, and it's a very interesting one that is not discussed in military terms by the U.S. military bloggers, people like Scott Ritter, Andrei Martyanov, Larry Johnson, and others. The contrary argument in Moscow is, the United States Army has never been weaker on the battlefield than it is now. The German Army has never been weaker than now. The British and the French, likewise. The Poles, likewise. Our enemies who have been fighting us on the battlefield have been defeated. Every weapon they've put on the battlefield, we've shown we can destroy. We've shown we can penetrate with hypersonic missiles any air defense they can throw up. So delaying to enable them to recover their strength makes no military sense, no military sense at all. So there is an argument for taking the opportunity now from Trump before he goes or before he does whatever is necessary, he thinks, to retain power. The opportunity that the Russian side can see of Trump causing division among the Europeans is also arguably in Moscow an opportunity, though we've said I think it's deception. The Chinese perfectly well understand that they are the major target of Trump and are in no mood to negotiate a reduction of tariffs. They see this as a fundamental existential test of strength, and they're not delaying for temporary deal making. Well, have the Chinese got the clock better organized than the Russians? Or is the Chinese system much clearer in command and control than the Russian system? Question, I haven't got an answer for it. But what the source is ultimately saying, what the answer to your question is ultimately to be that there's an argument for Russia to delay and an argument for Russia to move on. And over the last 24 hours, for example, we've seen the westward offensive on each of the five major directions or salients westward towards Kiev increase the pace by at least 10% over the average of April. So the military argument isn't going to be debated as openly as I've just said, nor should it. It's military and security secret. But there's an argument for delay, there's an argument against delay. And that's a political, ultimately a political decision that has to be made with in the light of Russian public opinion and American public opinion on the Trump side. Now, the other interesting thing that I've discovered in the last 24 hours is that American public opinion is not moving to end the war with Russia, as Trump seems to be doing. The most recent polls that I quoted in the last Dance with Bears indicate the ABC Washington Post Ipsos poll shows that a very substantial 45% of American voters sampled believes Trump has been too friendly with Russia. And only a tiny minority, I think less than 15%, thinks he's not been accommodating enough with Russia. And the balance are either unwilling to say they know the answer, or they believe that Trump has more or less the balance right. Well, that means that American public opinion facing Trump in the midterms in 18 months and then in 2028, American public opinion is not swinging against fighting Russia. Russian public opinion, on the other hand, is in favor of fighting the war so that it can't be fought again. So Russian public opinion is not strongly in favor of delay unless the terms of delay reward Russian public as the war is rewarding them.
Well, the American public has the luxury of not having a shooting war on their borders. That's similarly, the Chinese too. Your source also says, and this is more ominous to me, quote, we understand a bigger war is coming. This is a deal, the three-year deal, as stable as Trump's mind. It seems to me, John, that both of these camps that you describe, the one camp in Russia saying, you know, we should finish this war, I'm paraphrasing, but quickly, yeah, and the other saying that we should delay and refortify ourselves. But both of these camps are acknowledging that war is inevitable now or later, hotter or cooler and then hotter, but it's going to be war no matter which way it's sliced.
That says it exactly. I can't add to that, Chris. You're right. That's the way people see things, and I believe it's a realistic appreciation of the situation. So then the question becomes, if a bigger war is inevitable, and that we began with by saying that's a war between Russia and Germany again, a German rearmament funded by the United States. That's a reminder of Hitler, financed by Joseph Kennedy, JFK's father. Russia knows all about that history. It paid for it in blood. It doesn't want to fight it again. So the argument, especially next week for Victory Day, and especially during Victory Day, not only that the display of the forces on parading on Red Square, but it's the display of the Immortal Regiment that's the public parading down Gorky Street, down the center of Moscow, showing photographs of their loved ones, their grandmothers, their grandfathers, their brothers and sisters who were lost or killed or starved to death during World War II. The Immortal Regiment is a display of Russian solidarity in blood. And I happen to have my relatives who belong to the Immortal Regiment too. None of us want to see a delay that enables Germany to get stronger, to build better tanks than were able to survive on the Ukrainian battlefield, to fly their Taurus missiles for longer distances with bigger payloads at the Russian hinterland. That's what Merz and Badefull, the coming foreign minister, intend to do. And the Immortal Regiment parade is a parade that says to the Germans, we don't want and we will not allow you to fight us again to inflict that level of bloodshed. And that's a very, very powerful argument against delaying now.
Well, there's another anniversary in May. May the 12th marks the 80th, or 81st rather, birthday of General Keith Kellogg. He is the Trump point man on all this. He is the one that called the proposal, the three-day ceasefire proposal, absurd. And he's not much more in favor of the 30-day peace proposal. I don't know, does he favor the three-year plan that's floating just beneath the surface?
It's, again, a problem of understanding a man whose mind is not too bright. my colleague Ray McGovern refers to the general as and his words and plans as Kellogg's cornflakes, and doesn't.
And he is the grandson of the famous Kellogg's as well.
Is he really?
He is indeed.
I didn't know that. Thanks for telling me. I'd say he's exactly.
You say
what
the cornflake doesn't fall far from the.
Well, I would say it's a case of the rice bubbles. He's all snap, crackle, and then he's pop. He was to have been sidelined and fired weeks ago. On the one hand, he was one of the two authors of a paper that we reported at the time, and we discussed at the time back in April of 2024, that became the slogan base, the foundation for the slogans of the Trump presidential campaign. He wasn't the only one writing for Trump, but Trump's moved on, and as president now, he takes papers from the Marathon Initiative, a think tank of Wes Mitchell and Eldridge Colby, who's now the number three strategist in the Pentagon. And it would appear to on the surface for the past few weeks that Kellogg had been, had been overtaken and relegated by, on the one hand, the Mitchell-Colby faction in the Pentagon, but on the other hand, by Witkoff as a personal emissary of Trump to Putin. And Witkoff was in a position to negotiate directly with both sides. Kellogg was too clearly aligned to the Ukrainian side. But Kellogg has not been relegated. He's not been fired. He hasn't been pensioned off. So he very confidently said on television a day ago, I speak with the authority of the President of the United States. This is what Trump wants. So he's confident that he and the people behind him want a settlement with Russia that fundamentally weakens Russia. It doesn't give Russia relief to rearm. It gives the Europeans and the Americans behind them all the opportunity to rearm, refortify, and plan for the bigger war. And the bigger war involves Germany first of all. Germany based now in Poland, because the Germans have taken over Rzeszowa, I never get this southeastern rail hub, an airport hub in southeastern Poland. I never get its name correctly pronounced, but it's been the US hub for the supply of the Ukrainian war. It's the point at which everyone visiting Zelensky in Kiev has flown in and then taken the train eastwards to Kiev. The base there has been taken over by the Germans and the Norwegians with the Poles. The US has withdrawn, but not out of Germany, elsewhere in Germany. So the long-term war, the long war, is another war with Germany, backed by the United States and NATO. That's what Kellogg is articulating, and he's doing it in a pro-Ukrainian, pro-European way. In my opinion, he simply shows that it's the other side of the Trump war-making strategy. It's part of the sequencing of not two wars at once, and he's simply saying what they've all agreed to do. And where we are right now is Putin is saying, show us your cards, your real cards. Is this what you're really capable of doing? And if you can't control Ukraine when we offer a three-day ceasefire or the Easter ceasefire or the energy infrastructure ceasefire, and we can't agree on a Black Sea maritime ceasefire, if all of these things you can't deliver, we conclude you don't want to deliver, and everything's a deception. We move onwards, westwards, to capitulation of the Ukrainians, the elimination of that battlefield as a future platform for a German invasion of Russia.
Well, we have to move onwards, John. We're out of time, but if listeners want to know more, you, John, did an interview this morning on Nima Alkhurshid's program on YouTube, Dialogue Works. I urge people to check that out and other interviews you've done with Nima over the past. John's website, again, johnhelmer.net. You can see his voluminous writings on especially Russian topics there. Thanks a lot for coming on again, John.
Thank you, Chris. But hey, wait a minute. Guerrilla Radio has been the long-term platform for what we talk about. It's generous of you to refer to other podcasts. Other podcasters don't do that. So it's a kind of generosity that Canadian listeners shouldn't misunderstand. Guerrilla Radio is the only platform for our kind of conversation, Chris, for an understanding of the mistakes the Canadian regime, particularly our anathema, Chrystia Freeland, and it's the only platform for understanding Canada's role in this terrible war-making story, the war against Russia, the war against China. And I don't recommend that anyone devoted to Guerrilla Radio exhibits any disloyalty at all to Chris Cook and Guerrilla Radio. We say what we think more clearly. Guerrilla Radio is one of the only platforms in the North American podcast universe that uses the dreaded word, the truth word, that what we face is an imperial war against the trade of the enemy, that's China and Russia and Iran, an imperial war on the battlefields of the Ukraine and ultimately or soon Taiwan. So don't give up on Guerrilla Radio and move to anywhere else, folks.
Well, I can't add to that. And that's all I got for this week. Until the next time. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone.